Today's program is brought to you by Tabard Inn, new American cuisine in one of Washington, D.C.'s oldest hotels, located in DuPont Circle. For more information, visit tabardinn.com.
Hey, 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 I'm Jimmy Carboni from Beer Sessions Radio. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Greetings and welcome to Animal Instinct here on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Celia Kutcher, and I've got an exciting show today. We're going to talk all about the oceans, but before that, I just got back from Burning Man, and so did my guest, Matthias Elliott. We were toying with a thought about doing something about animals at Burning Man, but there are no animals at Burning Man, so therefore we're going for a much heavier topic. So that being said, we're going to talk about how carbon emissions affect the acidity of the ocean and what that does to the ecology from plankton to apex predators. So get comfortable and listen in. So, Matthias, thank you so much for being here today. I really, really appreciate it.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
How are you today?
I'm doing quite well. How about yourself?
I'm good. I'm still in recovery mode, but, you know, we're here, so let's do it. So, first question. Tell me about yourself and your background.
So, I am currently working as a UI engineer and as an artist, actually, as well, but I have had about an eight-year career as a marine scientist, particularly as a chemical oceanographer and an ecologist. I started in my undergrad doing research and worked mostly on water quality in the Amazon River Basin, and then also worked on some juvenile fish attractors to support like fisheries population research. I went to the Center for Ocean Technology after that and worked on experimental monitoring equipment. So I looked at nutrients and carbon system, was really focused on essentially making the equipment that would let you do really, really high resolution measurements in the ocean in specifically rather than taking samples and bringing them back to a lab. So really kind of increasing the quality of the view that you're getting with that research.
Cool.
Then in graduate school, I worked as a researcher at the College of Marine Science at University of South Florida in based out of Tampa Bay, but we were over in St. Pete, Florida, and did research up and down the Atlantic seaboard in the eastern tropic Pacific, all the way up to the Arctic. I worked on the Deepwater Horizon blowout to a certain degree.
Wow.
Quantifying where the subsurface plume was going, and then also did research at the Aquarius Habitat, which is sort of like going to the International Space Station for marine scientists.
Wow.
So I didn't get to saturate and stay there, but I did support research around the habitat while other divers were saturated.
Wow.
My thesis research was I conducted the first survey of trace metals and inorganic carbon system parameters in surface waters.
Wow.
And this was specifically to look at, to support fisheries research, looking at exposure to elements in seawater.
Mm.
And then I've also had a startup in renewable energy sources to essentially generate power for marine instrumentation left on the seafloor. So kind of a general focus on ecology and engineering.
Wow. And so obviously you've done your research in a bunch of different bodies of waters and a bunch of different oceans and seas. So the information that we're going to talk about today, is that pretty consistent all over the world?
There are definitely spatial distributions as about where acidification is greater or less, and a lot of that's related to upwelling and subsidence of water, surface waters to the deep.
Mm.
There's actually a lot of different, you know, when you think about like a glass of water, if you stir salt into it or pour salt into it, there'll be a gradation between the top and the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
There's some, this is not an exact metaphor, but it's you can think of it much in the similar, the upper 1,000 meters, which is kind of the photic zone where sunlight can reach and sunlight can permeate and allow photosynthesis and primary production
mm-hmm.
to occur, is very, very different than the bottom waters, which are stratified by a thermocline. So there's a density difference that there's not a lot of mixing that happens there. Most of that occurs in like the North Pacific and Atlantic and these areas where there's subsidence and around the poles.
Okay. And so for people that don't know, tell us about ocean acidification and what that means.
So ocean acidification is often referred to as kind of the ugly stepsister to climate change.
Mm.
It's also impacted by carbon is the main driving force. And to understand ocean acidification, you kind of have to first understand what acidification is. And so pH is the inverse logarithmic measure of the number of hydrogen ions. So it's basically a way of taking these really big numbers of just counting every single hydrogen ion that's floating there and making it a much more accessible number, like, you know, 1.3 or 7, which is pure water. Mm-hmm. It's considered neutral, not an acid or a base. Lemon juice, for example, would be like a 2, a pH of about 2, and bleach is a base at a pH of about 12.
Okay.
So there are definitely spatial and depth variations between the surface, you know, both the surface and the depth, and then across different oceans. But kind of if you take a gross summary of the ocean state as a whole, for about 300 million years, ending at about the Industrial Revolution, the pH was about 8.2, and now it's 8.1. And I know you might be thinking like, oh, well, that's just a 0.1 change. Yeah. That's not much. But 0.1 is actually a 25% increase in acidity.
Wow.
So, and it's because of that logarithmic scale. You also may think, well, okay, well, 8, that's above 7. 7's neutral. Like, a pH of 8 is not an acid.
Yeah.
But we're not talking about specifically about whether it's an acid. Even if we burn every bit of carbon reserves, it's not expected to make the ocean a true acid like, you know, we think of as like vinegar or lemon juice or hydrochloric acid or something like that. But it is becoming more acidic. And so then that has impacts on every single animal and every single organism that has to excrete a shell, essentially, or excrete parts of their body. And it can create additional stress on their metabolism. And so what ocean acidification is functionally is essentially a change to the chemical nature of the ocean.
Okay. Okay. And then what goes on in the ocean to make this happen?
So every single time, like, you know, if you go out and you look at the waves and that kind of thing, and when the wind blows on, the waves will spill over, and each time that happens, little tiny bubbles get created, and we call this kind of entrainment of air.
Mm-hmm.
And so they get pushed down, and so the nature of essentially gas laws and the way that they react in water is that when you increase pressure, it becomes much more soluble. You can essentially get more in as it gets deeper. So even, like, a couple feet will force more of that to dissolve.
Mm.
So that air, as it gets trapped in tiny bubbles and dissolves, essentially gets incorporated in the water. Once it's there, the CO2 that's in the air bonds with water to form what's called carbonic acid. This is the same type of acid that's in, like, carbonated soda, for example.
Okay.
And that's why sodas are often, like, acidic and that kind of thing. There's other chemical stuff that goes into that, but with beverages that are highly dependent on the beverage, but that's the acid created by carbonation.
Okay.
This is a very unstable acid, so we call it protonates, or it dissociates very quickly, so it pops off one of those hydrogen ions.
Mm-hmm.
So if we get back to that definition of pH, that's essentially increasing the amount of hydrogen ions, so the pH decreases.
Okay.
And what's left from carbonic acid is this ion molecule called bicarbonate.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a free-floating molecule, and essentially it's not very useful to organisms. But it's essentially a carbonate atom with a hydrogen ion attached to it. And so that extra hydrogen ion that was popped off of the carbonic acid can then go, and a large percentage of it will go and bond with another carbonate atom. And so then it takes that carbonate and makes that also unavailable.
Mm.
And this is so shell excreting organisms typically create these matrix shells out of a substance called calcium carbonate.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's calcium bonding with carbonate.
Yeah.
If it becomes bicarbonate, they can't do that. It's not something that they can utilize. So it becomes both the materials you need to make your shell become harder, and also at the same time, the state of it makes it harder to do deposition processes as a whole, because the acid wants to pull apart these crystalline structures. So it's kind of a double whammy of making the shell excretion process more difficult.
So actually, this is Matthias and I are friends, and we've known each other for quite a while now. And actually, I didn't know about this whole side of him until about a week ago. But so we were at the beach yesterday, and I have a question I meant to ask you yesterday, and I totally forgot. I was walking along the shoreline and was finding shells, but everything's broken. Everything's really, really thin. They're really, really brittle. And, you know, there used to be small shells when I was a kid that were about the size of your fingernail. And basically, the rule was, if you could squeeze them and they didn't shatter, they'd be good.
Mm-hmm.
Everything shatters now. Is that due to this?
You know, I can't speak to that specifically. It's
fair
possible
enough.
It impacts. There's, it's hard to take anecdotal experiences like
totally.
That and to extrapolate an actual causal relationship. And I know for probably a lot of your listeners, it's frustrating to hear the way that like scientists very heavily qualify their answers the way I am now, but it's there's a focus on not speaking beyond what you know and to accept that like there's a lot that you don't know. And the more that we learn about, you know, essentially the way the world works and the way the universe works, the less that we, you know, we become more aware of all the things we don't know. And so certainly it could easily be a contributing factor. It could also, mm-hmm. there could also be ecosystem sweeps of where you have, possibly more wave action going on due to increased storms, which are happening because of, climate change right now. The strength of storms are happening. That causes a lot of impact and damage to shells, particularly after they're no longer, like once they're in the essentially the crash zone of the waves. It could also be that you have an increase in various worms or parasites that, you know, from some other ecological pressure or mm-hmm. the same kind of ecological pressures that are causing them to break down more readily.
So when you're talking about shelled animals, we're talking about like snails, mollusks, clams, oysters.
Crabs as well. The corals also, they're also impacted by it.
The corals, the whole corals things kills me. I mean, that's the one where I like stay up at night. And so, yeah, I mean,
I wish I had good news for that.
Oh my God, I know. And it's a lot of people don't realize that coral is actually an animal, and it's the mm-hmm. exoskeleton, which is when you go to a reef, it's like a gazillion of these things, exoskeletons. And so what's happening to the reefs with the acidification?
So, There's been a bunch of interesting research. I know Kleypas in 2006, he worked with NOAA, showed a lot of reductions in recruitment of larval corals, and there are increases in bleaching. So it's generally like what seems to be happening is that so both the thermal stress created by climate change and then also the ocean acidification stress, are making it harder for larval coral to both develop and then also to excrete their shells. And they're more sensitive to like diseases when they come through. So whether you've had like black spotting or white spotting occurring, there's a lot of impacts that come from this and essentially exacerbates this whole process. Unfortunately, between climate change and ocean acidification, corals are likely going to go extinct or exist in very, very small patches. They're failing very quickly, and it was very hard over that time span in Florida of even in that span watching systems that were much healthier and much more vibrant transition to more algae-based life, you know, in those regions.
Well, that's terrifying because, I mean, there's a million different animals that live on coral reefs and make it their homes and their entire thing.
It's often compared to the rainforest in terms of biodiversity. It's a very, very rich environment, and it provides essentially structural housing and shelter and ecosystem for so many species beyond just coral and beyond just the kind of the pretty organisms that we often think about as being valuable.
Yeah, because something like a sea anemone, if it doesn't have a coral like to live on, it's not. It can't just like hang out on the ocean floor.
They need certain environments.
Yeah,
definitely.
Wow. Okay. Well, you know what? What are the primary causes of ocean acidification?
So in short, essentially us.
Yay!
it is. Essentially driven by carbon, emissions.
Mm-hmm.
This is really the primary forcing, the primary cause, and it's looking like about a third to a half of every bit of carbon that we release mm-hmm. ends up in the ocean, and while that has been essentially about a half to a third of it is ending up in there, and it gets dissolved and it ends up in the ocean and is essentially entrained, and then it has these impacts on the organisms. It also affects on a geological scale in that calcium carbon depositions that already exist in the ocean mm-hmm. are more readily dissolved.
Wow.
And there's some fear that this will lead eventually to possibly slumping and tsunamis and that sort of thing just strictly a geological standpoint. But that's kind of still in the theoretical hypothesis stage. So typically, when you think about carbon, there's like, oh, well, what about, you know, we breathe a bunch, animals breathe a bunch. It shows up from things rotting and decomposing.
Yeah.
And before the Industrial Revolution, essentially, there were about 220 gigatons coming from rotting material. There are another approximately 220 gigatons that were from respiration. But terrestrial environments absorb about 440 gigatons. So it's kind of a net zero.
Mm-hmm.
From marine sources, it was the same kind of thing, but the number is about 330 gigatons that were both emitted and sequestered.
Wow.
Humans are emitting 26.4 gigatons annually.
Jesus.
And so in terms of total output, China's our number one polluter at about 26.4%.
Uh-huh.
The U.S. is second with 17.3%, and the EU is third with 13.3%.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm shocked.
Developing nations tend to be very carbon-heavy.
Mm-hmm.
Cultures to live in. It's you know, a lot of our a lot of what we do, both our industry, our recreation, our transportation, and the hyper individualized kind of nature, particularly of Western cultures, leads to a higher impact from us. So if you look at it from a per capita basis, on the other hand, China is actually only 55th because there's so many people in Europe and Central Asia because of a lot of their public transit and energy structures is closer to 38th, and we are 8th. So
wow.
We're essentially one of the most flagrant polluters in terms of individual impact.
USA, USA.
I believe it's Qatar is actually the number one per capita, but because
really?
They're such a small country and there's so few people, they don't have as much of an impact as
right.
we do in the U.S.
Right.
So essentially, for about 650,000 years, CO2 was about 180 and 300 parts per million in the atmosphere. It's now past 400 parts per million.
Wow.
In 2005, when I started working on this at Eckerd, it was closer to 280 parts per million. And we are expected to broach about 500 parts per million by 2050. And,
oh, my God.
Essentially, every single estimate that we do for carbon, we have either reached or broached our worst-case projections
wow.
from previous studies and projections.
Wow. So. Well, we need to take a quick break, so okay. we're going to catch our breath here for a minute and a half. We're talking to Matthias Elliott all about the acidification of the oceans here on Animal Instinct. We'll be back in a minute and a half.
The following program has been brought to you by Tabard Inn. Tabard Inn, Washington, D.C.'s quintessential small hotel, is located on a quiet, tree-lined street just 5 blocks from the White House. Vibrant yet unassuming, the Tabard is comprised of 40 sleeping rooms, each unique in character and design. Feast on eclectic American cuisine in their acclaimed restaurant, or enjoy a cocktail and listen to live jazz in one of their cozy Victorian seating areas. Mingle with travelers from around the world who find the Tabard the only place to stay when taking their travels to Washington. For more information, visit tabardinn.com.
And we are back. I'm talking to Matthias Elliott all about carbon emissions and the acidity of the ocean, and it's a pretty intense conversation. So we're going to continue it. So, Matthias, we were just talking about the primary causes of ocean acidification and people's involvement. So how do we know that this is man-made?
Well, so one of the ways that we address that is that we look at stable isotopes. And so when you learn in your high school science classes or your middle school science classes that elements have a certain number of neutrons, protons, and electrons and a certain weight, that's not strictly speaking true. Elements can have either greater weight or lesser weight based on the number of neutrons that they have.
Huh.
There's some variability in this. So if you've heard of radiocarbon dating, that's looking at an isotope of carbon called carbon-14. It essentially has 14 neutrons instead of 12. It still has the same number of protons, the same number of electrons. It still behaves chemically quite very much the same, but it's... because it has this extra weight, it behaves differently. And so radiocarbon-14 is a radioactive element, and it decays into other elements.
Okay.
Where what we look at is carbon-13. For this climate science, we're looking mostly at carbon-13, which is a stable isotope. There's no decay that occurs.
Cool.
And so plants are, in their process of photosynthesis, can actually discriminate very, very well between 12 and 13.
Oh, wow.
And they prefer the lighter form, so they don't take up as much carbon-13. So fossil fuels are essentially very, very strongly enriched in 12, depleted in carbon-13, essentially. They're more carbon-12 than carbon-13 by a very, very, very high percentage. And what we've been seeing is that with essentially, with the Industrial Revolution, with the increase in carbon concentration in our atmosphere, we also are seeing a reduction Of the carbon 13 to carbon 12 ratio. Hmm. So essentially you're having more carbon 12 and less carbon 13, which goes in line. It's essentially like a chemical and an isotopic fingerprint for fossil fuel and okay. for stuff that's coming from these plants. And again, it's not coming from these terrestrial areas because they've been very clearly shown to be balanced. It's not coming from the ocean because those are balanced in terms of emission sinks. And the only place it can come from is essentially fossil fuel. And so we've seen that increase.
Yeah.
And so globally, that's about a 1.5 parts per thousand increase. And
wow.
Greenland's closer to 5 parts per thousand. And
wow.
so we're seeing, that's really how you know that it's coming from fossil fuel and therefore from us.
Wow.
So, yeah.
So how does this affect animals?
Essentially any, so it's, there's kind of a couple ways that it impacts animals. So any shell excreting organisms, there's a direct impact.
Mm-hmm.
So this is like pteropods, which a lot of you may not know about, but it's, they're essentially this free swimming snail that has an aragonitic shell, which is a type of calcium carbonate structure that's more easy to dissolve. It's not protected by a mantle. So when you see like really pretty shells and they've got all these color striations,
yeah.
that's this crystalline mantle that those organisms excrete over. And it actually helps protect the shell from dissolution, from damage.
Huh.
Pteropods don't have this. And they basically swim around in the ocean and snap up very small plankton. And they're like this delicious, juicy nugget for like yearling fish.
Mm.
And so Richard Feeley with the University of Washington has demonstrated that there's thinning that's been occurring in concert with ocean acidification.
Mm.
And in lab tests, they've also been showing that it creates a thinning in their shell. Additionally, like oysters, there's been widespread oyster death of larval oysters in Oregon, California, Washington. And this is, I guess, Bednarstek. I always have trouble with her name, Nina Bednarstek from NOAA. So she did this research from about 2005 on and has shown that this is impacting oysters. Foraminifera, which are small organisms, both pelagic up in the ocean and also benthic on the seafloor,
mm-hmm.
They also are susceptible to, and of course, what we talked about earlier is corals. So that's kind of the direct, like, this is happening, who does it hit first? But then this causes indirect impacts in that they cascade up. So, like, fisheries depend strongly on pteropods. About year-old fish, tuna, herring, salmon, all these fish that we are all quite fond of eating, of course, they have this kind of cost-benefit to essentially how they get their food. So if you think about your own daily life, you need to have a certain amount of income happen from the amount of work you expend so that mm-hmm. you can handle your housing and your food and all of that. Animals are no different in that they expend a certain amount of energy and they have to have at least equal amounts, if not more, energy that they get from their food when they eat it.
Mm-hmm.
And fish, unlike us, you know, they don't have a fork and knife. They can't chop up food and take small morsels. Some of them can bite chunks off, but it's kind of a dog-eat-dog world. And
mm-hmm.
they basically are essentially limited to what they can get down in one bite.
Yeah.
And so for about a year-old, salmon or tuna, like, a pteropod is just this juicy nugget of food that's just right.
Mm.
And so they all kind of depend upon this. And so then that continues to cascade up the trophic, or essentially the food chain,
totally.
Produce trophic levels. And so all the charismatic megafauna, like seals and sharks and dolphins and orca that we all love and enjoy and think are super cute and interesting and cool, they all depend upon these organisms for their food.
Right.
So there's quite a bit of fear in the fisheries researchers and in the ocean acidification research groups that as we see these essentially damage and impact happen to these snails and to these small shell excreting organisms, that then these larger animals are not going to have enough to eat. And so we'll start seeing whole ecosystems collapse.
Wow.
And we've had some fisheries not coming in like they used to do. And this is, of course, like the ocean is a very hard thing to do research on. And funding is always rough with it, but this is happening kind of at the same time. And it starts, you know, there's always a danger between correlation and causality for certain, but, lab experiments have shown a lot of linking to these, to the impacts of ocean acidification to these biological impacts to these organisms. And it goes in line with what we would expect from understandings of these ecosystems.
Right, right.
So it's really very a scary impact. Sadly, this is not like a super feel good report that I have to get.
Welcome back to the new season. Yay. So. No, but honestly, I'm really glad that you're here because these are topics. I mean, you know, we can talk about like cute dogs and puppies anytime. And this is a topic that's really important. And I think people have a clue about it. I think people are more aware of like sunscreen damage to mm-hmm. reefs and things like that, you know, mm-hmm. but like to get the real details and actually talk to someone who's been there and has researched this, it makes it that much more real. And it is a scary topic. I mean, this is not the happy pants topic of the week. However, I think it's a really, really important one. So, I mean, I really thank you for being here and tolerating all this sadness and doom and everything else. But, you know, next question is really like, is there anything that we're capable of doing as an individual human being to help this at all?
Well, so there actually is quite a bit. And there's a lot of frustration in the scientific community, I think, because the climate change issue has been, and you know, this is related to climate change. It is impacted by carbon emissions at every bit as much as, you know, what global temperatures are doing. And the issue has been politicized and it's been made a political issue. And I honestly, at this point, still don't understand how that is, because I don't see this as, you know, this is not something that's like a wishy-washy aesthetic, like, oh, I want it to be a certain way, or I wish the world looked like this. It's something that is a very real threat that is going on and is affecting already the entire globe and is affecting humanity and will continue to increase in its impact. And so essentially the sooner that we can roll back our carbon impact is really the best possible thing to do. So on a personal level, things like, you know, carpooling, turning down your heat and air conditioning, when you go somewhere, even if you can prefer train travel to buses, which is better than bikes, which is better than cars, which is better than airplanes, you know, making that kind of those kind of sacrifices, you know, don't keep your heat as high in the winter. Don't have your AC as cold in the summer. Try and find more activities and things to enjoy that are not as energy dependent, and to use much more energy efficient influences in your life. Reducing the amount of concrete that is poured. So energy is what we talk about a lot, but concrete is a massive mass, both from the energy perspective and also the chemical process. It emits a ton of CO2.
Really?
So reductions in those really, really help. And then on a policy level, this is something that really does have to happen at a national level and at an international level. And really, the more that you can send a message to your representatives, to the president, whoever that may be this fall, to senators, that this is not a Republican or Democrat issue, it's not libertarian, this is a human issue. Yeah. This is something that affects all of us equal, and to encourage caps to carbon emissions, to have real impacts to companies that violate them, to fund subsidies for renewable energy. That's really the only way that we're going to maintain our population, is if we can get alternative energies that are strong. Increase funding for research for alternative energy and climate change, and support public transit initiatives when they happen. We had the opportunity in Florida to have public transit installed, and it was voted down because of a 1% sales tax increase.
Oh, come on.
Which is, like, I get it. I don't want to pay more taxes either. I don't think anyone does. But that could reduce both traffic discomfort. And of course, you know, I'm sitting in Brooklyn, New York now, and we have fantastic public transit. It doesn't always work as well as we want, but it's there. But that does make a very real difference. And then additionally, refuse to support political candidates that deny that human influences to climate change and ocean acidification exist.
Yeah.
In Florida, Rick Scott placed a ban on public employees mentioning climate change, sea level rise, and global warming. Those words public employees are not allowed to use.
Unbelievable.
So Miami can't get federal money to deal with sea level rise caused flooding. And one scientist who I know was placed on administrative leave because they attended a conference, and in the session that they were presenting in, they just took notes as they're supposed to on the topics they went to. One of the talks was on climate change. They were placed on administrative leave.
Oh my God.
And had to go through essentially a psychological evaluation before they were allowed to return to work out of their own pocket, which this is not how science or democracy works.
This whole science thing, and you know, the past, I'm not even sure how many years it is, definitely less than 10, but this whole thing of like, well, I don't like that, so I'm not going to believe it, is kind of like, I mean, the level of denial is one that is truly outstanding.
I mean, it's amazing how much, you know, you do research and you go into it and you have hypothesis and maybe you have things that you want to be true or not to be true, but there are a lot of structures in place in publication that if you don't have the data to back it up, then you can't make the claims that something is other than what it is.
Yeah.
So it's an important thing to keep in mind that I don't think that there's really any other field that has as much a focus on ensuring responsible reporting. And part of that's the peer review process.
Yeah. Well, it's also, you know, this is something serious. Like you said, it's going to infect the entire planet. And so it's not like, you know, Jersey screwed or something like that. I mean, it's all of us. And so you would think that we could get some kind of worldwide agreement, because at this point, we're not living on Mars or going to the moon or anything.
Yeah. I mean, we're trying to do that. And there are arguments because of the risk of, you know, that we need to have our species off of just one planet, because it's basically having all of your eggs in one basket. But we need to be able to live here as well.
Right.
And if we can't make it work here, where else are we going to be able to make
this
it work?
This is why we can't have nice things.
Exactly.
We suck is basically what this episode is all about.
Not exactly. It's, you know, I don't want to go like,
no,
that we
that's
suck.
Not fair.
It's, you know, we make these, we do what makes sense for us, you know, in the time that we do it.
Absolutely.
And the issue is that when we, you know, we need to have rigorous examination of what those impacts are from our behaviors and to adjust from them. This is something that we have to learn to cope with, and we have to learn to move past, or we are not likely to survive it. There's this, you know, this question of like, oh, well, you know, what, we're ruining the earth, we're killing the earth. The earth is actually going to be fine. Give it a couple hundred thousand years and nobody will even know that we were here.
That's true.
We've only been around for 200,000 years. If you give it 5 million, you know, the way we're going, give it a couple thousand, and you probably won't even know that we were around. So, like, the Earth, you know, there have been mass extinction events in the past.
Yeah.
The Paleo-Eocene mass extinction about 56 million years ago saw similar carbon levels, but it took 70,000 years to recover.
Wow.
To put that in perspective, we've been around for 200,000, and we've been doing agriculture for 12,000.
Yeah.
So these are impacts that we're going to carry with us, and the more we can reduce them now, well, it's sort of like you're reducing the amount of debt that you're going to have to pay back and the amount of struggles that we're going to have to overcome. At this point, we're going to have to deal with some for certain. There are going to be real impacts. There already are from climate change. If you know, in a lot of low-lying parts of the world, they're being flooded. But
oh, yeah, those little tiny islands in the Pacific,
like
Vanuatu and all them,
and
they're like gone.
Yeah, a lot of them people are being flooded out of their homes and are not able to go back. During the Bush administration, the naval joint chiefs of, it was led by the Office of Naval Research, but they essentially put a memorandum across Bush's desk saying that climate change was the biggest threat to our national security. These are things that they're going to have impacts. The military's behind it. The Navy funds a lot of research now. And I think that, you know, if we start tackling this, then we can make the transition, but we have to actually make a concerted effort and we have to start prioritizing it.
And like, is any of this at all based on just like pollution and like plastic and people just throwing crap where they shouldn't and that sort of thing?
I mean, that's kind of a separate issue, but I would say that the consumptive, single-serving society that we have now of, you know, get your latte with a plastic lid, throw it away, all of that requires actually, like, manufacturing and requires resources. I mean, the plastic is coming from oils in most cases, in some cases now. I think Starbucks is now using plant-based plastics, which is fantastic.
Good.
But, you know, having a consumptive approach to living rather than a do it well, do it right, and try and make something last as long as possible is driving this as well. I mean, you go back to the 80s, they had the old saying of reduce, reuse, recycle.
Totally.
In that order.
Totally.
First reduce the amount you're using, then try and reuse what you're using, and last place, recycle it if you have to. Because recycling is still very, very energy costly. It's better than throwing it away, for certain. Don't get me wrong. I don't want to discourage any of you from recycling.
Yeah.
But if you can not even have to recycle, if you can use materials like stainless steel cups and stuff that have a lifetime worth of use, then
totally.
It goes much smoother.
And you wind up saving a lot of money in the long run, too, you know, which is a nice thing. But like those K-Cup coffees make me nuts.
Mm, yes.
Like those things are like the, you know, individually packaged peeled fruit, which I understand. If you have MS or you have trouble with, you know, your digits or functionality, then that's a really great thing. But it's
most
like,
of us don't.
Yeah.
Most
you
of
know?
Us are totally capable of measuring out our
or
coffee.
Like the 4-ounce bottles of water. Those are great. Those are super helpful. Thank you so much. I really needed that. You know, so it's that kind of thing. And I mean, it cracks me up because like when I was a kid, you know, it was like the hippie generation was pretty intense. And so, you know, everyone's like, goddamn hippies. And all the hippies are like, you know, let's eat vegetarian and drink out of mason jars and stuff like that. And so everyone's like, bunch of damn freaks, cut your hair, and no one's getting their messages. Mm-hmm. And now the messages that are there, a lot of them are very commonplace, which is awesome. But it's also like, you know, helping the planet and doing good things and reducing your crap is not a hippie concept. It actually makes your life a lot easier. You
Definitely.
Know, it's simplify, simplify, simplify. And we're in such a consumer culture right now where it's, you know, I need the new bag, I need this, da 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 da. And it's, you know, all that shit that I've bought's wound up in a dumpster or donated to somebody at some point, you know. So it really becomes like, how much money do you want to spend on stuff, especially stuff that you can throw away? And it's affecting everybody. You know, I've heard that horrible statistic, which please tell me if I'm wrong, that the oceans are supposed to be like empty by 2050 or something horrifying.
2050 is not looking like a good year for really any of us. It's and it's coming awfully quickly.
Yeah, it is.
It's there are all, you know, it's essentially become one of these benchmarks where, you know, we're going to break 500 probably by then or before in
wow.
terms of parts per million of CO2. Corals are not expected to survive past that point.
Jesus.
Pteropods may not as well. Foraminifera are also, they're talking about being extinct by then, or at least large populations of species. It's coming, and it's coming quickly, and I think we are already starting to see impacts if you are willing to pay attention, not even just from a scientific perspective, but just generally to look at what's going on and to see how these things are changing.
It's true. I've gone snorkeling in a couple different places on vacation, and I was in Jamaica, and I was in Antigua, and I don't remember the last one, but it sucked. And all the reefs are white. All of them are dead. There's like one sad clownfish and like three parrotfishes that look like they should have died 6 months ago, you know? And it's just too many people and too much is going on with it, and people standing on the coral, which please don't touch the coral. Don't stand on the coral. It's not sexy. You're not cute getting an Instagram photo standing above the water because you're killing all the coral.
I mean, just brushing it with a fin stroke can kill a coral head. They're very, very fragile, and they live kind of, they excrete their shell, which is quite sharp, and then they live as this communal organism. And if it gets ruptured, then it's like having a wound in your arm.
Oof.
It opens it up to having bacteria get in there and infection, and the entire head can die very quickly, especially as we've seen a lot of viruses transported across the ocean and across ocean basins that, you know, where they used to only be seen in the South Pacific or just in the Indo-Pacific or just in the West Indies and, you know, like the Caribbean Ocean.
Yeah.
Now they're starting to show up across places because of, you know, being carried in ballast water from shipping.
Or, yeah, yeah.
So it's a very, the world's gotten so much smaller and so much mixing going on, and it creates a lot of situations that the organisms that live there can't cope and can't adapt quickly enough. I mean, there is one organism actually that is profiting from ocean acidification, and that's jellyfish. So, as a surfer and a diver and a lover of the beach, I am, you know, I actually really loved studying jellyfish. They're incredibly cool animals, but they are not something that I would like to see as the dominant species.
No kidding. Oh, my God.
For personal reasons of I don't like getting stung.
Yeah, they hurt. They're no fun. They're evil little bastards. I mean, it's like no face and they'll still get you. It's miserable. I hate those things. They're so pretty, though. But so, I mean, you know, I think that, I mean, I'm assuming that one of the best ways to help this is educate, educate, educate. If you
For
have
certain.
Children, please teach them about this because they're the generation coming up. And we all that are here and grown-ups already, we need some help. And we need a lot of help. And kids are really, really good with causes. They go nuts on them. And, you know, we're talking about the animals, too. You like seafood? Slow down on it. Don't eat so much. Like, let's take this in stride here, you know. And the more we know about this, the more we can help. I mean, I apologize for the bummer of the episode, you guys, but it's something that we need to know. And it's something that the more we deny it, the more screwed we are. Mm-hmm. So as for the listeners, I really appreciate you guys tuning in. I appreciate the ones of you that have stuck through this the whole time. I promise next week's going to be a lot lighter than this one. But I also appreciate you guys for allowing me to give me a platform where we can discuss stuff that's actually really real and really, really serious. So, Matthias, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Do you got any parting notes? You got anything anywhere anybody can look if they want to look up more about this?
I would say if you've got an aquarium near you, then they are often excellent resources for this. In terms of if you're... For seafood lovers, Monterey Bay Aquarium puts out a guide. They actually have an app on iPhone
That's
and Android that will tell you what organisms are better to eat and which ones you should steer clear of. And for just general information on marine science, Woods Hole, of course, here in the Northeast is one of the globally preeminent research institutes and Scripps on the West Coast. Monterey Bay Aquarium is fantastic. Mm-hmm. The National Ocean Atmospheric Administration puts a lot of information. And, of course, you know, our old friend Google. Google is excellent resource. You can go down rabbit holes searching for it. And Google Scholar will give you, if you want to look at peer-reviewed journals, they can be a little dense to read, but the more you try, they'll start to unpackage.
Mm-hmm.
And Google Scholar, you usually can't read whole articles because there's this is a whole argument going on in the academic world right now about making public research more available to the public rather than having it behind a paywall. That's a topic for another time.
Yeah,
entirely.
That's a whole other show.
But you can read abstracts at least, which is the summary of kind of what they did and what their results were.
Cool. So, Matthias, thank you again.
Thank you so much.
I really appreciate it. And I'm really impressed at how smart you are. This is amazing. This is so cool. I've got smart friends. Yay. So once again, listeners, I'm back for another season. Thank you guys so much for tuning in. I got a Facebook page. It's Animal Instinct. Look for the cat with blue hair. We're on Twitter at Food Healer. Join us. It's fun there. And you get all kinds of wacky cat and dog and animal information. That being said, thank you all. I will see you next week. I hope you have a good one and take care.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.